I sat there in the back of the police Chevrolet, listening to a tiny voice in my head asking me what the hell I was going to do about that. Finley drove straight through Margrave and parked up outside the station house, right at the curb opposite the big plate glass entrance doors. He and Roscoe got out of the car and stood there waiting for me, just like Baker and Stevenson had 48 hours before. I got out and joined them in the noontime heat. We stood there for a moment, and then Finley pulled open the heavy door and we went inside, walked back through the empty squad room to the big Rosewood office. Finley sat at the desk. I sat in the same chair I'd used on Friday. Roscoe pulled a chair up and put it next to mine. Finley rattled open the desk drawer, took out the tape recorder, went through his routine of testing the microphone with his fingernail. Then he sat still and looked at me. "I'm very sorry about your brother," he said. I nodded, didn't say anything. "I'm going to have to ask you a lot of questions, I'm afraid," he said. I just nodded again. I understood his position. I'd been in his position plenty of times myself. "Who would be his next of kin?" he asked. "I am," I said, "unless he got married without telling me."
"Do you think he might have done that?" Finley asked me.
"We weren't close," I said, "but I doubt it."
"Your parents dead?"
I nodded. Finley nodded, wrote me down as next of kin.
"What was his full name?"
"Joe Reacher," I said. "No middle name."
"Is that short for Joseph?"
"No," I said. "It was just Joe. Like my name is just Jack. We had a father who liked simple names."
"Okay," Finley said. "Older or younger?"
"Older," I said. I gave him Joe's date of birth. 2 years older than me.
"So he was, 38.
I nodded. Baker had said the victim had been maybe 40. Maybe Joe hadn't worn well.
"Do you have a current address for him?"
I shook my head. "No," I said. "Washington, D.C. somewhere. Like I said, we weren't close."
"Okay,"
he said again.
"When did you last see him?"
"About 20 minutes ago," I said, "in the morgue." Finley nodded gently.
"Before that?"
7 years ago," I said. "Our mother's funeral."
"Have you got a photograph of him?"
"You saw the stuff in the property bag," I said. "I haven't got a photograph of anything." He nodded again, went quiet. He was finding this difficult.
"Can you, give me a description of him?"
"Before he got his face shot off?"
"It might help, you know," Finley said. "We need to find out who saw him around, when and where."
I nodded. "He looked like me, I guess," I said. "Maybe an inch taller, maybe 10 pounds lighter."
"That would make him what, about 6'6",
he asked. "Right," I said. "About 200 pounds, maybe." Finley wrote it all down.
"And he shaved his head," he said.
"Not the last time I saw him," I said. "He had hair like anybody else."
7 years ago, right?" Finley said.
I shrugged. "Maybe he started going bald," I said. "Maybe he was vain about it." Finley nodded.
"What was his job?" he asked.
"Last I heard, he worked for the Treasury Department," I said. "Doing what? I'm not sure."
"What was his background?" he asked. "Was he in the service, too?"
I nodded. "Military intelligence," I said. "Quit after a while. Then he worked for the government."
"He wrote you that he had been here, right?" he asked.
"He mentioned the blind Blake thing," I said. "Didn't say what brought him down here, but it shouldn't be difficult to find out." Finley nodded.
"We'll make some calls first thing in the morning," he said. "Until then, you're sure you got no idea why he should be down here?"
I shook my head. I had no idea at all why he had come down here, but I knew Hubble did.
Joe had been the tall investigator with the shaved head and the code name. Hubble had brought him down here, and Hubble knew exactly why. First thing to do was to find Hubble and ask him about it.
"Did you say you couldn't find Hubble?"
I asked Finley.
"Can't find him anywhere," he said. "He's not up at his place on Beckman Drive, and nobody's seen him around town. Hubble knows all about this, right?"
I just shrugged. I felt like I wanted to keep some of the cards pretty close to my chest. If I was going to have to squeeze Hubble for something he wasn't very happy to talk about, then I wanted to do it in private. I didn't particularly want Finley watching over my shoulder while I was doing it. He might think I was squeezing too hard. And I definitely didn't want to have to watch anything over Finley's shoulder. I didn't want to leave the squeezing to him. I might think he wasn't squeezing hard enough. And anyway, Hubble would talk to me faster than he would talk to a policeman. He was already halfway there with me. So exactly how much Hubble knew was going to stay my secret, just for now.
"No idea what Hubble knows," I said. "You're the one claims he fell apart."
Finley just grunted again and looked across the desk at me. I could see him settling into a new train of thought. I was pretty sure what it was. I'd been waiting for it to surface. There's a rule of thumb about homicide. It comes from a lot of statistics and a lot of experience. The rule of thumb says, when you get a dead guy, first you take a good look at his family, because a hell of a lot of homicide gets done by relatives. Husbands, wives, sons, and brothers. That was the theory. Finley would have seen it in action 100 times in his 20 years up in Boston. Now I could see him trying it out in his head down in Margrave. I needed to run interference on it. I didn't want him thinking about it. I didn't want to waste any more of my time in a cell. I figured I might need that time for something else.
"You're happy with my alibi, right?" I said.
He saw where I was going, like we were colleagues on a knotty case. He flashed me a brief grin.
"It held up," he said. "You were in Tampa when this was going down."
"Okay," I said. "And is Chief Morrison comfortable with that?"
"He doesn't know about it," Finley said. "He's not answering his phone."
"I don't want any more convenient mistakes," I said. "The fat moron said he saw me up there. I want him to know that won't fly anymore." Finley nodded, picked up the phone on the desk and dialed a number. I heard the faint purr of the ringtone from the earpiece. It rang for a long time and cut off when Finley put the phone back down.
"Not at home," he said. "Sunday, right?"
Then he pulled the phone book out of a drawer, opened it to H, looked up Hubble's number on Beckman Drive, dialed it, and got the same result. A lot of ringtone and nobody home. Then he tried the mobile number. An electronic voice started to tell him the phone was switched off. He hung up before it finished.
"I'm going to bring Hubble in when I find him," Finley said. "He knows stuff he should be telling us. Until then, not a lot I can do, right?"
I shrugged. He was right. It was a pretty cold trail. The only spark that Finley knew about was the panic Hubble had shown on Friday.
"What are you going to do, Reacher?" he asked me.
"I'm going to think about that," I said. Finley looked straight at me. Not unfriendly, but very serious, like he was trying to communicate an order and an appeal with a single, stern, eye-to-eye gaze.
"Let me deal with this, okay?" he said. "You're going to feel pretty bad, and you're going to want to see justice done, but I don't want any independent action going on here, okay? This is police business. You're a civilian. Let me deal with it, okay?"
I shrugged and nodded, stood up and looked at them both.
"I'm going for a walk," I said.
I left the two of them there and strolled through the squad room, pushed out through the glass doors into the hot afternoon, wandered through the parking lot and crossed the wide lawn in front over as far as the bronze statue. It was another tribute to Casper Teal, whoever the hell he had been. Same guys on the village green on the southern edge of town. I leaned up against his warm metal flank and thought. The United States is a giant country. Millions of square miles,
best part of 300 million people. I hadn't seen Joe for 7 years, and he hadn't seen me, but we'd ended up in exactly the same tiny spot, 8 hours apart. I'd walked within 50 yards of where his body had been lying. That was one hell of a big coincidence. It was almost unbelievable. So Finley was doing me a big favor by treating it like a coincidence. He should be trying to tear my alibi apart. Maybe he already was. Maybe he was already on the phone to Tampa, checking again. But he wouldn't find anything, because it was a coincidence. No point going over and over it. I was only in Margrave because of a crazy last-minute whim. If I'd taken a minute longer looking at the guy's map, the bus would have been past the Cloverleaf, and I'd have forgotten all about Margrave. I'd have gone on up to Atlanta and never known anything about Joe. It might have taken another 7 years before the news caught up with me. So there was no point getting all stirred up about the coincidence. The only thing I had to do was decide what the hell I was going to do about it. I was about 4 years old before I caught on to the loyalty thing. I suddenly figured I was supposed to watch out for Joe the way he was watching out for me. After a while, it became second nature, like an automatic thing. It was always in my head to scout around and check he was okay. Plenty of times I would run out into some new schoolyard and see a bunch of kids trying it on with the tall, skinny newcomer. I'd trot over there and haul them off and bust a few heads, then I'd go back to my own buddies and play ball, or whatever we were doing. Duty done, like a routine. It was a routine which lasted 12 years, from when I was 4 right up to the time Joe finally left home. 12 years of that routine must have left faint tracks in my mind, because forever afterward I always carried a faint echo of the question, "Where's Joe?" Once he was grown up in a way, it didn't much matter where he was. But I was always aware of the faint echo of that old routine. Deep down, I was always aware that I was supposed to stand up for him if I was needed. But now he was dead. He wasn't anywhere. I leaned up against the statue in front of the station house and listened to the tiny voice inside my head saying, "You're supposed to do something about that." The station house door sucked open. I squinted through the heat and saw Roscoe step out. The sun was behind her, and it lit her hair like a halo. She scanned around and saw me leaning on the statue in the middle of the lawn. She started over towards me. I pushed off the warm bronze.
"You okay?"
she asked me. "Yeah, I'm fine," I said.
"You sure?"
she said. "I'm not falling apart," I said. "Maybe I should be, but I'm not. I just feel numb, to be honest."
It was true.
I wasn't feeling much of anything. Maybe it was some kind of a weird reaction, but that was how I felt. No point in denying it.
"Okay,"
Roscoe said.
"Can I give you a ride somewhere?"
Maybe Finley had sent her out to keep track of me, but I wasn't about to put up a whole lot of objections to that. She was standing there in the sun looking great. I realized I liked her more every time I looked at her. "Want to show me where Hubble lives?" I asked her. I could see her thinking about it.
"Shouldn't we leave that to Finley?"
she said. "I just want to see if he's back home yet," I said. "I'm not going to eat him. If he's there, we'll call Finley right away, okay?"
"Okay," she said.
She shrugged and smiled.
"Let's go."
We walked together back over the lawn and got into her police Chevy. She started it up and pulled out of the lot, turned left and rolled south through the perfect little town. It was a gorgeous September day. The bright sun turned it into a fantasy. The brick sidewalks were glowing and the white paint was blinding. The whole place was quiet and basking in the Sunday heat. Deserted. Roscoe hung a right at the little village green and made the turn into Beckman Drive, skirted around the square with the church on it. The cars were gone and the place was quiet. Worship was over. Beckman opened out into a wide, tree-lined residential street set on a slight rise. It had a rich feel, cool and shady and prosperous. It was what real estate people mean when they talk about location. I couldn't see the houses. They were set far back behind wide, grassy shoulders, big trees, high hedges.
Their driveways wound out of sight. Occasionally, I glimpsed a white portico or a red roof. The further out we got, the bigger the lots became. Hundreds of yards between mailboxes. Enormous, mature trees. A solid sort of a place. But a place with stories hiding behind the leafy facades. In Hubble's case, some sort of a desperate story which had caused him to reach out to my brother. Some sort of a story which had got my brother killed. Roscoe slowed at a white mailbox and turned left into the drive of number 25. About a mile from town, on the left, its back to the afternoon sun. It was the last house on the road. Up ahead, peach groves stretched into the haze. We nosed slowly up a winding driveway around massed banks of garden. The house was not what I had imagined. I had pictured a big white place, like a normal house, but bigger. This was more splendid, a palace. It was huge. Every detail was expensive. Expanses of gravel drive, expanses of velvet lawn, huge, exquisite trees, everything shining and dappled in the blazing sun. But there was no sign of the dark Bentley I'd seen up at the prison. It looked like there was nobody home. Roscoe pulled up near the front door and we got out. It was silent. I could hear nothing except the heavy buzz of afternoon heat. We rang on the bell and knocked on the door. No response from inside. We shrugged at each other and walked across a lawn around the side of the house. There were acres of grass and a blaze of some kind of flowers surrounding a garden room. Then a wide patio and a long lawn sloping down to a giant swimming pool. The water was bright blue in the sun. I could smell the chlorine hanging in the hot air.
Some place, Roscoe said.
I nodded. I was wondering if my brother had been there.
I hear a car, she said.
We got back to the front of the house in time to see the big Bentley easing to a stop. The blonde woman I'd seen driving away from the prison got out. She had two children with her, a boy and a girl. This was Hubble's family. He loved them like crazy, but he wasn't there with them. The blonde woman seemed to know Roscoe. They greeted each other, and Roscoe introduced me to her. She shook my hand and said her name was Charlene, but I could call her Charlie. She was an expensive-looking woman. Tall, slim, good bones, carefully dressed, carefully looked after. But she had a seam of spirit running through her face like a flaw. Enough spirit there to make me like her. She held onto my hand and smiled, but it was a smile with a whole lot of strain behind it.